Right. It's what? It's taped. Is it taped? Okay. I'll start all over again. Mm-hmm. Right. This is a workshop forum, a best practice forum, and I'm intrigued that the title is The Courage to Provide Balance. We certainly at the BBC like to feel that we do that as a matter of course, not with any particular courage, but that's for you to decide as well. And this is being promoted by the World Broadcasting Union as well as the BBC and Panos. And what we want to do is really project information in the next half hour, particularly about how to realize the potential of the internet when it comes to the kind of things that we're going to hear from the data and the research are clearly critical areas. Particularly the exploring of mainstream media providers and providing balance, as I say, and encouraging cultural pluralism and helping users to create and evaluate what they find on the web. So this is a contribution to understanding the dynamic which is at work. Now, we had planned to make it clear that this was not just about the developed world, not just about Europe, by opening it with Panos. But unfortunately, their representative is not able to be with us now, even though that they're a key element of promoting this session. So that's an explanation as to why you're not going to hear so much from the developing world. Let me first ask Matteo Maggiore, who represents the BBC in Brussels. Matteo, give us the data that you've got, and then we'll hear from Alex from the EBU.
Thank you very much, Nick, and good afternoon, everybody. I have to provide a health warning in the sense that I'm going to talk about a study that the BBC has commissioned jointly with the EBU. About the relationship between broadcasting and the internet. Clearly, you won't be surprised to hear that the BBC sees a very clear and important role for itself in the changing world, but it is a changing world, and it's changing so fast that it really challenges every assumption about how the interrelationship between content providers like the BBC and the evolving technology really take place. So it is an independent study which we have commissioned to look, first of all, at whether there is some evidence of the role that broadcasters have played so far in the development of the internet, the challenges and opportunities that lay ahead, and how broadcasters and the internet can work more closely in the future. Their interim findings, the study will be finalized in January. Now, in a nutshell, the key finding of the study is that broadcasters can play a very important role in the future development of the internet, cooperating with other players with mutual benefit. They can, subject to certain conditions and certain scenarios taking place, but there is scope for a mutually beneficial relationship. And this will happen essentially in three ways, according to the authors of the study. The first is the most traditional way in which broadcasters provide content, which is high quality, trusted, and helps drive the internet take-up. The second finding is that broadcasters will be crucial partners for network providers in ensuring that investment can happen based on assumptions that give comfort to both sides of the partnership. And finally, the broadcasters have experience that is unique to helping the internet adjust to a world in which it will have to pay more attention to citizens' concerns about standards and protection for vulnerable groups and so on. We've heard a lot about what yesterday somebody defined as the Darwinian model of convergence going forward, how effectively convergence means that the strongest will take hold and the internet effectively will expand to encompass and affect an Anschluss of other technologies in the communications universe. The study takes a different approach. It sees a sort of evolutionary development of the relationship between broadcasting and the internet. This relationship started, you remember, with a classic exercise in underestimating the importance of a new medium on the side of broadcasters. We saw very much the internet as a complement to the established traditional media, television and radio, which were our core business. Wasn't terribly exciting, didn't work terribly well. We found actually in that first incremental phase that the things that worked best were those that we developed as native to the new medium of the internet. When we decided to launch a BBC News, for example, and this is not about the BBC, but it's just the example that I know best, of course, a BBC News site as opposed to a program site of a BBC bulletin, we found that actually that was incredibly successful because it dealt with the internet as a fully-fledged reality and it was native to the medium. But going forward, there is evidence that both broadcasters and internet players are thinking in more converged ways. Broadcasters are beginning to make use of third-party platforms through which users access their content. Content is provided for users to re-edit and incorporate in their own online sites. Archives become open for general use. And in fact, all distinctions become blurred, the distinction between the service provider and the user, but also between technology and resource. Is Wikipedia technology or is it a resource? Is Google a content provider or a tools provider? Despite all their protestation to the contrary, and we heard them even this afternoon in one of the workshops that I attended, Google does not produce any content, but yet it is one of the most trusted content providers in the perception of users of the internet worldwide. So there won't be a transfer of broadcast-type policy to the internet, perhaps, but certainly there won't be an obsolescence of the broadcasting universe either. So what is the what has been the effect of the broadcasters have had on the internet so far? Well, the study finds that there certainly has been an effect, and it's been beneficial, although very, very hard to quantify. This effect has been to promote access to the internet, to provide content, and to raise the awareness. It's all based on the fact that television still remains an incredibly pervasive medium. In the UK, people use the television 8 times more than they use the internet, even internet users. Averagely, we watch 3.5 hours of television every day. Internet users go online for about half an hour. So there is a value of impact of television that is incredibly strong, and as there is evidence that information is by far the decisive element in driving the uptake of internet in the UK, there has been certainly an effect. Now, there you go. Sometimes you just shake it. How does broadcasting content help the internet specifically? Well, through its pervasive influence, broadcasters promote their online offer overall. They promote individual programs. They promote program-specific activities around which user generated content clusters. As new online services emerge with richer content and greater functionalities, we find that increasingly people use the internet to access that kind of content. The percentage of American internet users that use online video every day has grown from 9% to 14% in 1 year. There were about 2 billion clips downloaded, 2 billion more clips downloaded between March and July. In the US alone. But what is more interesting and crucial is that according to one report that a study mentions, around 62%, so a big majority of online video viewers, so those people that actually use the internet to download videos, the great majority say they prefer professionally produced videos. In other words, we found what we anecdotally see through our experience daily, that there is a lot of professionally produced video in the social networking sites, and those tend to be incredibly successful and often preferred. So clearly the role of the brand plays a major role. Obviously, trust in the content that you access through the internet becomes itself a bigger factor with internet growth. And there again, broadcasters are very well placed to give a strong contribution to internet development. A GlobeScan survey found that 82% of respondents in 10 countries across the globe trusted national television most for, as a, you know, of all mediums, of all media that they accessed. Only 25% trusted the internet most, and that was that came well after national newspapers, local newspapers, radio, international satellite television. So the internet has somehow a problem of trust and perception, and relying on broadcasting content can help address that issue. Another conclusion that the study came to is that broadcasters can help secure the funding, and this funding to develop networks will be extraordinary. The funding required. Calculations vary, and this is all only an indication, if you like, but certainly 14 billion euros to upgrade to 90% the fiber to the home in the UK, 37 billion in Japan, is that right or not? But certainly we are in that category of investment. So network operators will have to make that investment, but they're not sure of the returns. And broadcasters can be partners if ways can be found to share both the risk and the returns. What the broadcasters would get out of that, of course, would be the exposure for their material, archive material, and so on, lower production and distribution costs, and a deeper and broader relationship with their audiences. And what the network developers would get in such a partnership would be reassurance that attractive content will be available, a sharing in the returns, and promotion of the benefits of further development of the internet. Of course, there is a health warning here about any partnership not having to lead to foreclosure of markets, but clearly there is potential for a development of the broadcaster's role there. And I come to my last slide, public policy recommendations and the last role for broadcasters. The study finds that public policy should encourage competitive markets, lowering entry barriers and ensuring that consumers are sufficiently well-informed to make effective choices, define and safeguard the public interest on the internet, and encourage broadcasters and others to find constructive partnerships. So, as I said at the beginning, there wouldn't be a transfer of the old broadcasting world to the internet, no takeover of all the media by the internet either. As the internet becomes more pervasive, some public interest objectives will become more relevant to the people who use them. Protection of minors and other vulnerable categories, content diversity, local production, multilingualism, and so on, and media literacy, or digital literacy, more to the point. And I would stop here. As I said, the final results of the study will become available in January. These are not BBC or broadcaster conclusions. They are just one contribution to the debate. But we think they echo some of our findings through our daily experience, which is that broadcasters are now moving to a transformational relationship with the internet, where there is a definite two-way traffic and complementarity, and there is great potential for synergies and benefits for users as well as challenges. Thank you.
Matteo, just before you, anything you want to say about the methodology?
The methodology is effectively a research about researchers. It is collecting the researchers available on these issues, and then finding ways of bringing them together in the context of the debate between internet and the media. So it is both a research and an intellectual contribution. It's a synthetic work, but designed to give issues for discussion based on existing research.
Just before we go on, does anyone want to pick up on anything on the methodology or just to check on anything that's been identified on the slides? Otherwise, we'll go on to Alex. No. Okay. Alex, Schulzitzky from the EBU, give us your data and your conclusions.
Thank you. Is this working? Yes. Before I start, I just want to pick up on three points or a couple of points of continuity from the earlier session today. I know that some of you were there. And if you remember, that session was about quality on the internet, user-generated content. And in my view, and what I'll try to show, is that this problem of having junk on the internet is going to slowly and naturally fade away as professional content becomes preeminent. It will displace, to a large degree, this kind of content. It'll always be there, but it's going to naturally move away. It's going to move away because big media, professional media, is getting more and more involved in the internet, and especially video, which can lead to another problem. If you remember, one of the speakers this afternoon said there are seven families in Brazil that control all the media. Well, there are seven companies in the world that control the media. And there, the extension of this dominance onto the internet could become quite a threat. The other thing that I want to say about the earlier session is that the BBC was sort of placed as a proxy for mass media. It's not. BBC is not a good proxy for mass media. It's an excellent proxy for public service media, but that is what I hope to show is a clear distinction between public and commercial kinds of broadcasters. We should have loaded up the other presentation. Maybe wake them up. Okay, maybe I will. I will just start, and then we'll catch up with the slides. Okay. Unless they can do it right away. All right. Perfect. All right, just a very quick reminder of why we're here. We're here to work together, right? There is no dominant sector, whether commercial or public or government, that is going to dominate this process. We're all here to work together. I'm going to skip on. I've been asked to shorten my presentation. So I'm going to start here, and I want to explore this concept, this so-called long-tail effect. And it's a phenomenon where usage is fragmented into a high number of users. And you see number of sites on the horizontal and number of unique monthly visitors on the vertical. And what startled me is how quickly this phenomenon manifests itself. These are only the top 100 sites in Europe, and already you see a long tail forming. And we did this, if you replicate this in national markets, across different sectors, this same pattern emerges. But let's look at what's in the head of this curve. This is where it's most important. And first of all, these sites have been growing at an average of 25% from last year. So they're popular, and they're getting more popular. And who's in there? Well, it's the usual suspects, Google, Apple, Microsoft, but it's also companies like News Corp, Time Warner, and Viacom, which have each of them increased in ranking over the last year. All right, now we looked earlier at only the top 100. What is the real long tail of the internet? And it's, you can't even see it, right? This, what I've done here, I've taken the measurable internet universe, which is about 15,000 websites, and this is the result. If you look at the first 750 sites, they have the same usage as all of the rest of those sites. In other words, the top 5% of sites have the same usage as the rest of it. It gets worse because 15,000 sites is only, I keep using this term measurable, The way it works is that reporting companies track about 500,000 sites. At any one moment, there's only some that register enough users. That's why I'm taking 15,000. But this 500,000 is only the tip of the iceberg. The total number of internet sites is estimated to be 100 times more than that. That's 50 million sites. Now, what does this mean? What's the point here? It means that the vast majority of sites, I mean vast, is absolutely inconsequential in terms of any kind of impact and certainly advertising potential. Most of the internet is comprised of specialized sites which are perhaps important in aggregate, but individually invisible. And the converse is true and interesting as well, that there's only a limited number of websites that control vast amounts of internet traffic, and the properties that are the fastest growing and the more influential are these big media websites. I'll just give you a history of the internet now, slightly abridged, in terms of funding and commercialization. We have to remember it started with public money, Department of Defense. It was developed with more public money from universities, academic institutions, the development of software, browsers, the World Wide Web was able to give the general public accessibility, and then the backbone was sold to MCI, Sprint, and companies like that. Meanwhile, during this process, the average internet user was clearly strongly against advertising commercialization of the internet. Now, of course, these were mostly nerds, but the point is still important. Now, after this, we see a boom, a bust, and a boom again, the stage we are currently in. And in the midst of this, someone very famous quite said, monolithic empires of mass media are dissolving into an array of cottage industries. This was said in about 1995, and this is probably wrong. Because the internet has become an important distribution platform for media. Online services like podcasting, streaming, on-demand are booming right now. And big media has a strong internet presence. They are always ranked in the top 50. They are in that head of that curve. What's really driving it now is, and what will make this technology a sustaining one rather than a disruptive one for mass media, is that advertisers are on board now. The advertising community is convinced that it works, the targeting, so they're on board. And that tells a story right there, I think. And what really clinches it is that they're starting to move budgets out of traditional media, especially radio and newspapers, into the internet. And this, it creates, there is no choice for mass media. They've got to go into the internet in a full-fledged kind of way. Now, let's look at some of these companies that I've been talking about. Here you see the growth among large media conglomerates. Now, what startled me is that if you include all of their subsidiaries, you know, books and music and publishing, we have found that you take just the top three companies and they control about 900 million users. That's unique monthly visitors, not unduplicated, which is a lot. It's a lot of audience, isn't it? Look, there's no question that this expansion is going to continue. The only questions are tactical. Do we develop our own site? Do we go through a gatekeeper like Amazon or Apple? Do we use advertising or a pay model? Do we grow by acquisition or internally? These are tactical questions. The strategic objective is there. And this is not unexpected. Large media groups will tend to extend their dominance into online space. The internet has not become a wonderful world of open, pluralistic information flow and dialogue. Global media conglomerates are not dissolving into an array of cottage industries. Rather, thriving cottage industries have been absorbed by big media. Now, let me say that there could be some negative effects.
skip this, sorry, in the interest of time. Right. So maybe this is not all good. Maybe too much commercialization can lead to some unwanted results. Pluralism. Certainly, internet is a, there are diversity of voices, but some of these voices are louder than others. In this long, long part of the tail, of the curve that we saw earlier, you are a voice in the wilderness. And for the most popular sites, there is a control at the top that can potentially be exercised. And this has an implication for pluralism. Advertising, look, at best it's a distraction, a banner ad. At worst it's misleading, a search result that is paid for. Pay models are just, by definition, they will exclude part of the population from access to this information. And in terms of diversity of content, you know, if you acquire different media content sources, it's, what is it, produce once, copy everywhere. So homogeneous product. By the way, did you hear about this deal that Google wants to do with libraries? their offer is to pay for the scanning, to put it on the internet without exclusivity. But there's a number of academic institutions and libraries that are refusing. Google has given them an offer they can't refuse, and they have refused. And I just want to—I just want to quote an individual who has formed an alternative to this called the Open Content Alliance, and he says, "God bless Google and Microsoft, and they'll do what they do. But we need to do the right thing because we're in a privileged position of thinking about what's good for the country and society over the long term." And indeed, public institutions are in a privileged position; they have responsibilities based on their public funding, and. What I wanted to talk about is public service broadcasters, and I had a number of case studies. I'll skip through those quickly. Strong presence, lots of interesting public service services provided. Oops. Right, that last one is DR, but let me just summarize this if I can. They are public service. The public service remit is the mission. For commercial operators, the mission is to engage online audiences with the ultimate goal of monetization and brand building and growth of businesses. For public service, the remit is to extend the public service mission to citizens, to provide pluralism, diversity, independence, and all those things that they already do in the broadcast sphere. So. And part of this, the funding is very important because in Europe, at least, most of the public broadcasters are publicly funded by license fee, which ensures this independence. And just let me finish up here. A point, just to nail this professional content issue. Here's our colleague from Google. He thinks professional content is important. If you look at YouTube, there is a number being promoted that 70% of content on YouTube is just uploaded professional content. I mean, it doesn't matter what if it's 50%, if it's 40%, it doesn't matter. It shows that there is this appetite for professional content out there. There are new platforms launching, Juiced, Babbelgum, peer-to-peer networks that have as their express business model distribution of professional content. Matteo mentioned the figure 62% of people who view user-generated content sites prefer professional content. These are people who go to user-generated type of sites. So I think that is very clear. I'll finish now, and if I can just conclude in a sentence, I think if you're interested in how mass media is going to be present on the internet, it's going to be a replication, a duplication of the industrial structure and the commercial and public strategies now. The way it works now in broadcasting will be extended into the internet if public service is allowed the legal and the financial wherewithal to continue their involvement.
Thank you. Thank you, Alex. That one graph that you had, which talked about the 750 and the 15,000, just the top slicing, what would be your definition of what is likely to happen then in the next year to 2 years on that pinch point on the left-hand side? That is going to get ever more vertical and thinner, that number, not 750. What number do you think it might get to?
Yeah, I think that number will go down. And again, it's
any suggestion of to what scale?
No, not at this point. But but the phenomenon is going to be driven by the fact that big media is either by growing their own sites, by acquiring, you know, the other bad effect of commercialization is the stifling of innovation. There's a good idea, it gets gobbled up. Or it gets Googled up. And so this concentration is going to continue. Less than 750, I won't hazard a guess.
And that last remark you made about public service broadcasters and how they could fit into this with the kind of funding models that they have.
Right. The public service broadcasters, at least in Europe, are part of that head of the long tail. And that's important. Because it's the only way to balance and to act as a counterweight against commercial media interests. And the extent to which they can continue to grow is limited by their legal remit and their funding remit. For example, one of the most advanced public broadcasters in this area relies on only 4% of their budget for all internet activities. That has to go up if they're going to grow.
Okay. Right, this is about data projection and conclusion projection. Carol, do you want to come in and do you have a view on this? Whichever hat you're wearing, but maybe as an advisor to the Council in Europe. I can provide you with a microphone, so we don't have to.
I'd like to return to the question of courage, because it does take courage for public service broadcasters to operate in the new environment, new digital and internet environment. First of all, because in many European countries at least, government policy has not been very clear on whether public service broadcasters actually can enter the internet and actually can operate in the new media. For example, the German broadcaster ARD wanted to establish the internet as the third leg of the company, and they were not allowed to do that by their government, because the government, under pressure from the commercial sector, didn't like to see public service broadcasting go into the new area for various reasons, which I won't go into. And courage was required for public service media to be operating in this area at all. The Council of Europe earlier this year adopted a recommendation on the remit of public service media in the information society, precisely in order to overcome this difficulty. One of the reasons we are talking about public service media and not public service broadcasting is to stress that this is no longer broadcasting. We're dealing with media, digital media. Mark Thompson of the BBC, Director General of the BBC, has also said in one of his speeches that the middle B in BBC has served the company very well for a very long time, but it is now questionable whether the middle B is still enough, whether something should not be done about this letter, because the BBC is much more than traditional broadcasting. And in this recommendation, we're saying public service broadcasters should be able to use state-of-the-art technology in order to go into all the new digital media and to operate in this new digital environment. And this has proved very useful. I've been told by public service broadcasters in some European countries, for example, Norway, that they use this text to talk to their government, to convince the government that this was the right thing to do, because many governments have still a very old-fashioned idea that public service broadcasters are into nationwide radio or television services, and that's all. Now, there's another reason why courage is required on the part of broadcasters who go into this new world. What we're seeing is what somebody has described as the mediatization of the internet and internetization of the media. What does this mean, internetization of the media? All traditional media, including newspapers, thanks to digital technology, are becoming new media. In other words, they're becoming interactive, multimedia, and they're able to combine mass communication with interpersonal communication. Now, for a traditional media company to readjust itself to this new method of operation takes a lot of courage and takes a lot of effort to overcome entrenched resistance from its own staff, which doesn't want to engage in multitasking, doesn't want to engage in learning new practices, doesn't want to learn to use new technology. And I'll give you an example. I was in Finland earlier this year talking about new technologies, and I was saying to the Wiley employees that you need to adjust to a new world in which the audience will write emails to you, and you have to reply back. And they said, one of the elderly gentlemen said, a journalist said, yeah, I don't have time for all of this. I would impose a limit, 3 emails per household per year to be sent to the public service broadcaster. That's the most I can accept. Now, this kind of attitude is completely irrelevant in the new digital environment. So, public service broadcasters, as you know best from your BBC example, which is reconstituting itself and reinventing itself to be able to operate in the digital environment, public service broadcasters have to completely restructure themselves. They used to be media-centric companies. You had public service radio, you had public service television. Now what you need to have is an organization capable of producing content for all the channels of distribution and produce it once. The idea is called COPE, create once, play everywhere. This takes a lot of effort to redesign the company, to teach people new skills. And when you have the courage to do this, you can be an active operator on the internet.
Are you suggesting the BBC should be the BCC, British Content Corporation?
Well, we discussed this.
That's an idea. That's come to me literally in the last 10 seconds.
This was discussed during the BBC International Day some weeks ago. And one of the top directors of the BBC said the BBC would be insane to change its name, given that it is so well entrenched. But yes.
In principle.
Well, it is. It is. But yes, this is why, as I said, the Council of Europe talks about public service media, not public service broadcasters. And over time, a new approach will be needed, and public service media will have to rebrand themselves to escape association with radio and television, which is what you have done in the BBC. There's no longer television in the BBC, there's vision. There's no longer radio, there's audio, which I understand encountered a lot of resistance from BBC employees who were attached to BBC radio. So a lot of things need to change for public service broadcasters to be able to provide the balance on the internet.
Yes, I mean, for those who are not familiar with this, when I left my office on Thursday, I was working under one system. When I return, hopefully on Monday, depending on the aircraft, it'll be a very different system where there's no head of television news, for example. And the change and the drafting of this has been dramatic. Obviously, Richard has been deeply involved in it and might want to say more about it, but the speed at which it's happened has been incredible. forced upon the BBC by a license fee settlement. But on the other hand, there has been a dramatic change, which might have taken several years, and I'm giving a very personal view here, instead of which it's been seismic, and is happening probably even as I'm standing here. So that's the speed of change. What I'd like to ask you, though, is how much of those two sets of research are actually going to be relevant to the kind of challenges that you are talking about there, Carol? The fact that, you know, particularly what we saw there with the long tail and the ever shorter long tail, how much is that going to focus minds, or is there going to be a constant process of catch-up by the public broadcasters simply because they're not prepared to move at the speed that the dynamic is dictating they should?
Well, a public service broadcaster needs a year to implement any important decisions and needs about 3 years to implement, a traditional public service broadcaster, that is, to implement any major project. Now, this is absolutely impossible these days.
You're saying that's too long.
That's much too long, much too long. So management will have to operate on a different, completely different time frame in order to be able to keep up with what is happening in the industry.
So what do you believe has to be done? And maybe anyone else want to join in this conversation about convincing the politicians, convincing the governments of just how urgent this is based on this kind of research, that the mindsets have got to change, not next year, but now?
Well, for a very long time in Europe, at least, both the European Union and the Council of Europe didn't really know how to approach this. The European Union still is saying that public service broadcasters should, in principle, be able to use new technologies. Now, I wonder what in principle means. Governments and international organizations are under heavy pressure from the commercial sector, which doesn't want public service media to enter into the new technologies. Why? Because for them it is the only growth area. This is the only area where they can make new profits. So they don't want competition from public service broadcasters. It's a struggle in every European country, and it's going to continue to be a struggle. And this is why I say that public service broadcasters, need to find a partner in the audience. It's not going to be very easy to find partners among politicians, but if they have the audience on their side, then politicians will think twice about consigning public service broadcasters to the old analog era, which sometimes they do.
What you seem to be saying is that we shouldn't be talking about the courage to provide balance, but the courage to accept reality, and pretty damn fast.
Yes, absolutely.
Matteo, Alex, what about your view? Build on what we've been hearing.
Well, first of all, just to say that I couldn't agree more with Carol and everything that's been said so far. I mean, there's clearly a regulatory challenge for broadcasters, public service broadcasters in particular, in certain countries. I'm happy to say that on one hand, in the UK, if we have a difficult funding condition, I'll come to that in a second, but at least from the regulatory and policy side, it has been recognized that the mission of a public broadcaster like the BBC is not dependent on any particular technology or platform. It is expressed in the form of public purposes for a public service broadcasting organization to be pursued across all platforms. So that in the UK, and I agree it is a bit of a privileged situation in Europe, but certainly the government has recognized that. But there is a regulatory challenge, there is a strategic competitive challenge or technological challenge, but perhaps the most momentous one is one of vision. And, you know, to see for broadcasters grown in an age of control, to see themselves develop in an age where control is no longer there. Somebody said, you know, give people control of the media and they will use it. Don't give it to them and you will lose them. And that is exactly what's happening, with the difference that it's not even ours to give anymore. So we have to adapt to surviving in a universe where everything's changed, and we are as public broadcasters, even pioneering people's access and use of technologies, which, in a sense, destruct and unwrap the content that we provide in a way that makes it much more difficult for us to get credit. At the same time, we have to open up very wide all our editorial processes to maintain the relationship with the audience and the trust of the audience. And all of this is the biggest challenge, certainly, that any broadcaster has ever seen in its history. The piece of good news that is emerging from research across the board is that users are doing lots of very strange things with the content and the internet and interactivity, and they are intrinsically unpredictable, difficult to follow, fickle, they change all the time, and it's very difficult to keep up. However, one thing is clear. They still value quality content. And that emerges very clearly for us across all platforms. Our problem is how to get credit for the quality content that we provide, how to get it to them, how to get them to find it, how to get them to use it in the way they want to use it, and so on and so forth. But it seems to me it's absolutely clear that there still is there a demand for high-quality content that requires a degree of investment and economies of scale. And this is what public service broadcasting certainly is about, what the core of our mission is about, to make sure that that content is available to people where they want it, in the ways that they want it.
Alex, yeah.
On the courage issue, it's really the courage to face up to the fear of the unknown. Mark Thompson also said that the iPlayer, which is this on-demand service by the BBC, is going to be the most transformational technology since color TV. Now, that's quite scary if you don't really understand the implications of that. On the issue, Carl was talking about the speed, the slowness with which public service broadcasters can respond. This actually worked to their benefit during this dot-com bust. If you remember, the media companies lost hundreds of millions, but public service media was relatively unscathed. I think at this point, it's a done deal. This is going forward, especially online video, the on player. This is happening, and I think next year, 2008, you'll see a lot of developments, and I think enough to convince politicians and regulators that this is how people are starting to consume. And to, you know, slow-moving hierarchies and organizational structures is one thing, but the way around that is money and funding. Money is very encouraging.
Can you see hybrid systems developing out of this? In other words, not just a public broadcaster or a commercial content provider, but hybrid models beginning to develop?
Well, we already see that. I mean, there are public broadcasters that, apart from the BBC, Nordic countries, are mixed models, are funded.
But developing that even more.
Or transferring that onto the internet. And it's happening now. You have mixed model funded public broadcasters that are allowed to advertise or promote or commercially exploit the internet. And you'll see partnerships, as Matteo's report illustrated, and all of that, yeah.
Matteo.
Yes, well, on your question about hybrids, there certainly is increasingly a drive, at least in the UK, but elsewhere as well, to make sure that the funding of public service broadcasters is increasingly used for the benefit of the whole system. One of the new purposes of the BBC is to help build digital Britain, and that in practice means bring a very considerable investment to the development of the distribution of services across terrestrial networks, but overall in general. So there is a sense that public service broadcasting becomes a resource for the system. And increasingly, there is a pressure for all broadcasters, all content providers, to partner up with the people who have to deliver the investment in the new networks, and ensure that that investment can happen in a condition of fairly foreseeable scenarios. Of course, it's not easy at all. find models that allow for cooperation that is win-win and still delivers what people want. And all of that without foreclosing the markets and ensuring that entry barriers remain low.
Yeah, I think these models are still in development. There's a lot of trial and error on the part of broadcasters going on. If you look at the U.S. networks, they are very different strategies. You have Viacom, for example, that has taken all of its content off of YouTube. They refuse to work with YouTube. You have News Corp and NBC that have banded together. They formed a website called Hulu, and this is where it's called the YouTube Buster. This is supposedly where all of their content will go. So there are strategic decisions about, do you build your own website, do you partner, or do you go through the gatekeepers? And the answer is going to be worked out individually by broadcasters, because the gatekeepers are important. If you remember, Apple, about 2 years ago, Apple and iTunes was the way to distribute audiovisual content on the internet. Since then, you've got the user-generated sites, you've got retail outlets like Amazon out there. So it's a work in progress.
Do you think, though, that there's a greater willingness now to accept that risks have got to be taken, and risks may fail occasionally, particularly for the public service?
The risk of under-engagement is now higher than all other risks, including copyright risks.
And the cost of not taking a risk.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, I wanted to say that public service broadcasters used to be self-contained, vertically integrated companies, which didn't need any cooperation with anybody. This is now over, because there are so many distribution platforms, because there are so many networks. A public service broadcaster, public service media organization, needs to be able to enter into cooperation agreements with the private sector. Otherwise, it will not be able to exist. But another point which I want to make is that in the 80 years of public service broadcasting's existence, the great change that has happened, in addition to technology, has been social change, cultural change. The old paternalistic approach to the audience, that you're there to educate the great unwashed, is completely today unacceptable. So if there is going to be, and it also takes courage, to come down from your high perch and to approach the audience on a completely different terms of equality and terms of partnership. This is what public service broadcasters are not used to. They're not used to being in direct touch with the audience. And what I think may guarantee the future of public service broadcasting is a new partnership with the audience, a new openness, a new ability to engage. Public service broadcasting exists on two pillars. One pillar is political will. The other pillar is popular support. Political will is weakening in many countries. Therefore, you need to build up public support. And you can only do this by entering into a new partnership, new openness, new transparency. I often give the example of the BBC telling its news editors to maintain blogs, so that editorial decisions are explained and the editors can be challenged and need to reply on the internet to the audience and to account for the decisions that they make. This is the road to the future, I think.
It is happening. David. Microphone, please.
It's okay, is it now? I was rather worried by all this, if I may. I'm David Wood. I'm from the EBU, but another part of the ship to Alex. In Alex's presentation, essentially, he gave us some incredible figures. For me, the first time I've heard them, you know, 500 or 50 million websites in the world, but only 750 of them matter. And the top three companies taking an audience of 900 million people. This is globalization on an incredible scale. And if you looked at the rate of growth of the companies, globalization happening much faster, much more strongly than in any other industry. The kids are out there who demonstrated against the cocoa industry for its globalization, and the real problem is right in front of them, isn't it? It's globalization of internet content. And
David, why are you worried? I mean, this is happening. You just surely have to accept it.
I'm worried because the potential impact, of course, on cultural diversity and all of these things that help to make the social ecosystem that we have. But why I'm worried is because, as I understood it, what you're saying is that somehow public service broadcasters can be the last bastion against this huge onrush of globalization. We can stand up against this great tide and somehow protect cultural values and so on. So I just wondered if that actually can be done on the one hand. And secondly, when Matthias was telling us about the BBC study, why it didn't have any of this kind of thing in it. He was talking about cooperating and so on and sharing risks with other companies. This can't be the way, can it, to prevent such a massive scale of globalization and the loss of all of the things that we appreciate so much about the internet, about its potential for the diversity.
But what about the alternative, which is you've got to keep exploring different options, different models, even as Alex says, some of them may fail, but the price of not trying them is even higher than taking the risk.
Yes, it is. But I do wonder why it was, if I may, you know, Matteo, that this issue of globalization of the internet content industry wasn't a factor when you talked about what it is that a public service broadcaster should be doing in the future.
The study that we conducted is about the relationship between broadcasting and the internet. So it really posited the question, is there the potential for a mutually beneficial interaction? And even the prospect of future scenarios and developments that see the internet becoming much more pervasive and much more relevant. And it is designed to look for answers to the question that we've heard repeated several times here. Will the internet, will there be an internet, internetization of the media, as Carol put it? Will it mean the end of broadcasting, or is there still a role? Clearly, the answer that the BBC gives is that there is a role. It is a role fraught with hard work, perils, and quite a few opportunities. Is concentration at the global scale a threat? To perhaps put my slant on your question and try and elude it that way. Well, it can be a threat. It can be a threat from certain points of view. We've seen that most of these sites tend to be aggregators. What are aggregators? Aggregators pose a threat if they are perceived as the originators of content, and people should take the success of an aggregator as a substitute for the need to invest in quality content if they want quality content. If somebody says, well, we have Google, so why do we need the BBC? We would get worried, and understandably, and posit that actually investment in content comes from broadcasters like the BBC. It does not come by their own admission from Google or other aggregators. There is another element to the equation, of course, which is it's great to think of the internet as a wonderful anarchic place, but clearly there is a misperception there. There are some big 800-pound gorillas in town, and 800-pound gorillas have the potential for breaking a lot of furniture. So to be concrete, it's great to have big investors deliver an effective and functioning network with the necessary investment in infrastructure. We need that. The world needs that much more outside of Europe than in Europe in prospect. The problem is if they become gatekeepers and the power that they may exercise in terms of regulating access. But these are, you know, I'm trying to Salamislice your question. Globalization per se is not necessarily a tragedy, provided we all understand who does what, and we can all provide our own bit of the puzzle.
I think it should be worrying, David, but not surprising, because this is just an extension of this globalization that exists, you know, in cinema, in television. You know, you look at the format industry, where, you know, the Big Brothers and these format shows are being globalized. But I'll tell you something really scary, though. I think that if you take the top 10 media companies, the top 10 internet companies, I think you'll have another AOL Time Warner thing. You know, they'll avoid the mistakes of that deal. But for a lot of them, the kind of merging of content with gatekeeping makes sense. That would be really scary if it happens. But in the end, it's not that frightening, because if there is a balance, if it's done in a healthy way, with the coexistence of commercial and public media, you have popular programming, you have public service sort of acting as a catalyst to improve content on commercial channels. In some countries in Europe, in many countries in Europe, it works in a very healthy way. And the only obstacle is that public service needs to get into the internet with the same rate that the commercial players are.
I'm intrigued that David's worried. You talk about scary. Isn't it actually formidable? In other words, potential for something quite dramatic, rather than being scared about it. Isn't it more scary to have two enormous institutions which are failing because they haven't seen the light and haven't seen the opportunities?
I think David and I were both being rhetorical. What I mean by scary is concentration of power, of ownership, of control, of eyeballs and clicks and all of that.
Giacomo.
I accept what you said for cinema, because it's true that cinema is highly concentrated industry worldwide. It's not true for television. If we bring back this comparison to the television situation in the country, it would be like in Italy, you have as most viewed television CNN, as the second most viewed television Sky News, as the third television most viewed in the country CBS. Broadcasters that are totally different from the culture of the country. This is a phenomenon that doesn't exist in any media apart of cinema. And cinema situation is not very healthy, as we know, because there is a huge concentration, and there is you need to fund with public funding in Europe in order to allow to continue to have an existence for in European industry of cinema.
Alec?
I don't know. I think if I go back to the office, I'll rip apart some of these primetime schedules. But my guess is that you will find American series on movies on television, or a format show that originated from a, you know, not necessarily American, but an endemol, a global media company. And my guess would be that a significant proportion of most European primetime schedules are composed of that.
What you have been saying in terms of concentration and the fact that the concentration in the media is being replicated in the internet and the type of sites and the number of sites that are most visited sounds concerning to me. The concentration of that type may, in certain cases, under certain conditions, become a threat to democracy. If you imagine a large corporation that can control the content suddenly deciding to misuse that power, in order to pervert democracy, that would be something very, very dangerous. Don't you think so? Perhaps we could have the reactions of the panelists.
I agree. I think in the not too distant future, you might have competition authorities looking at cross-media ownership rules and including internet properties as part of that. What I've shown here is the development, it's happening, but I really think 2008, 2009 will be an acceleration of this that may raise concerns among regulators and politicians.
When you say it'll raise concerns, do you think it'll happen belatedly or it'll happen simultaneously? Will they be playing catch-up, regulators?
It's always catch-up. But the market will happen, I think, in the next 12, 18 months. So when the regulators see it, the next 24, 36 months.
Right. John, do you want a quick word? I feel it's 7:45, and we're probably getting to the point where everyone's getting a little tired and a little thirsty and maybe a bit hungry. John.
I think the thirsty idea, is this on? Yes. There are, the first survey had a subtitle, or the creators of it called themselves human resources, yet there's been no mention of the, I'd say the BBC has should put the world back in world services. So the innovative, and put the first B in prominence. Channel 9, that's Channel 9 broadcasting to 350 million English-speaking Chinese, has a market of some size not touched by the BBC. I always wondered why, with the branding of BBC and the long and glorious history of world service, that tradition was abandoned in some sense and not carried out into this gigantic world of those that turned always to BBC for, well, take a look at Al Jazeera, a BBC creation, created by lack of funding in the Arab branch, which caused the group to go to Qatar and start up Al Jazeera. So the power, I think, of BBC is this tradition and the respect held by the world for BBC world service reporting. The way I read these long tail is a bit different. If there are 50 million websites and the total component of BBC creating the website, I doubt it's more than 50 people, it might be 20 people. That means there's 50 million website creators out there who have talent approximating the talent of those that build the BBC website. That means there's an enormous human capital. My point's not clear? I build websites now and again for various nonprofits. It takes 20 minutes to build a website. The capability to build something now is very broadly held, so that there are a large number of people that would benefit from the leadership, in some sense, of BBC in this professional quality. There's something circular about the assertion that quality always wins, but we're worried about our ability to attract people even though we're quality. It somehow doesn't quite close the circle of the logic. If it's high quality, then it will draw the viewers. So we shouldn't worry. So I'm asserting that there's a broad tail of talent out there that is entering this world of creating higher quality. So if we look at the real money, forget the public and forget essentially the money in BB, look at the power for those eyeballs. FIFA, IOC, Formula One, media moguls growing just because they have a more profitable contract with one or another of these guaranteed ways of drawing eyeballs to the screen, that territory is in some sense this long tail. If you go look on Brazilian television, you'll see the soccer development teams on television drawing people's attention, drawing people's eyeballs. There's something new happening here, and I think BBC can, in fact, with its quality, move into a domain of creating ever larger numbers of those that are capable of creating quality.
Is there a question there, John?
Well, there's a question. Are you interpreting this data correctly? If you look at the large number of people involved, to me, I'm an internet person, the internet is a pipeline What goes into the pipeline is completely dependent upon talent, creativity, and the energy to dedicate yourself to doing something that others find interesting. I read the long tail in a quite a different way. It says the BBC archives contain an enormous amount of incredibly valuable material that people would love to see if only they could find it, and if only BBC had moved its metadata tagging a few years and invested somewhat in being able to take value from the archives. So I think there's enormous gold here that's not quite captured in these studies, and it goes at the end to bringing what is valuable about what we've been calling broadcasting or public media. It's a paying attention to very serious human issues and societal issues in ways that the popular media does not. And that's, I think, the niche that is where the BBC could concentrate an investment in people that would in long term pay off much more than discussions about how we're able to copy Google or do something that attacks the quality of what is done by YouTube.
You're making a number of very complex interrelated points there, and certainly Sir Michael Lyons, the new chairman of the new trust, has said that the BBC is about taking risk, not necessarily looking for the biggest audience. Richard, do you want to come in on any of those points? Richard Sandbrook, director of the global division of the BBC.
I'm sorry, I'm not quite sure I understood John's point, to be honest with you. I think it could be... This shouldn't be about the BBC, frankly, but I think we are trying to do that. We are trying to be distinctive. We are trying to offer what commercial competitors won't. We are trying to put our archive online. We're constrained by funding. Some people say we'll do less then, so that's what we're doing. We're making several thousand people redundant, and then that's wrong as well. So, you know, whenever you're in the BBC, whatever you do, somebody says you should be doing something different. But at the minute, the strategy is absolutely to do things like putting the archive online, to focus on quality and to invest in digital, and that's basically the direction we're headed, and we're going through a massive reorganization to enable us to do that. I don't quite follow your point about investing in people, forgive me, but I mean I think overall your broader point about quality, I mean there is a logic that says, you know, of course if the quality is there, you know, people will follow, but that rather depends what you mean by quality. I'm not sure we're all talking about the same thing without being too semantic about it. Quality is important, but in a very fragmented world, obviously any public service broadcaster in particular competing against, you know, Time Warner and Fox and Viacom and 900 million up there is concerned that we're not delivering to quality to as many people that we receive public funds in order to get it to. And so how do we do that is the dilemma we face.
I'll just pick out something that I think I disagree with about the talent being out there, being evenly distributed. Is that what you, was that a point?
My point is if you look inside the World Service,
hang on.
I suppose my point on that is that what used to make a BBC cameraman quite a rare thing is now distributed so broadly.
I see.
And
I
there's
see.
Talent arising there.
Certainly.
We can find
All right.
innumerable examples.
Certainly. I mean, from the technical point of view, the barriers to entry virtually don't exist. But on the important issue of editorial and production quality, this certainly there's gold out there. You might find it out there. But it's a very, very rare thing. And broadcasters are unique organizations. They gather the right people, they have the technical equipment, and by the way, the technology, once we get into high definition world, that there may be another barrier of entry there. But broadcasters get the right people, right group of people together, editors, especially if you look at radio. Radio is starting to lose all meaning. I mean, as a distribution system over FM, AM, DAB frequencies, it's just an audio, it's just a voice or a music or an audio content. But radio is going to continue because you've got people who are experts in that medium. You know, editors, speakers, talented individuals that can put together content to be distributed in whatever way technology advances. So the
the fact that talent is out there, the internet is more than anything else a recruiting tool to find the talent that, if they are put in the right environment, can be nurtured even further.
Just to underline, though, that, again, when I return and others at the BBC return next week, there won't be a head of radio news anymore. It's a head of programs, not a head of television news. It's a head of multimedia newsroom. So things are changing dramatically fast, respecting just that principle. Please.
I would like to come back to the concentration issue, if I may. The concentration, I was surprised to hear the concentration concern in this setting with the people that are here. I come from El Salvador, just to let you know where I come from. And in Latin America, as you know, is most of the broadcasters are private and not public, different from Europe. And also, I would like to comment with you that the concentration and cross-media ownership that you were talking about, FCC, for example, in the U.S., they do have cross-media rules that prohibit to have different media types, and they are relaxing these rules. So this is the contrary to what is in Europe now. So I do concur with the idea that this concentration media might be a threat to diversity, but it's up to the people. If the people, the public that you serve, demand to have local content, demand to have content that is related to the culture of each country, of each community, then you will still provide this content. But if these people are convinced that what they want is canned content, then they will ask for canned content. And from the presentation, we hear that people are still for quality content. So I hope this quality content can also be translated into this diversified content that we talk about. But I'm not really sure that this is going to happen that way.
Right. I think we ought to make this the last thought, probably. Carol.
Yes, it's true that in many countries, also in Europe, limits on media concentrations are being relaxed. The reason for that is globalization. competitiveness of the media industry is regarded by many governments as more important than other considerations, including democratic considerations. I think many of these things that we have been talking about are both a threat and an opportunity for public service media. If public service media can prove that in these conditions they can continue to perform their role of defending national culture, of promoting the democratic process in their own culture, in their own countries, but also at the international level, because more and more decisions are taken at the supranational level. If public service broadcasters, public service media, can adjust to the new circumstances, change dramatically, but at the same time preserve the role that they play, then this will be an argument for their continued existence. So I would say that these dramatic changes are both a threat and an opportunity. And it is up to public service broadcasters to show that they have the vision how to change, how to adapt, and at the same time preserve the basis nature of the role that they play in society, preserve their remit.
Matteo, final thought.
Well, Carol has said it almost all, what I want to say. I thought that Alex was perhaps a bit optimistic when he was predicting that public policy will wake up to potential dangers of concentration. I don't think it will. I think that regulation will increasingly go towards a relaxation of rules about cross-media ownership and all the classic pluralism rules, because it's very difficult to define
what the problem is in a formal way. Negative regulation, behavioral regulation, loses impact and effectiveness in a network universe. So together with the drive that Carol mentioned to get investment on networks, get a competitive industry worldwide in a globalized environment, that will mean that regulation will actually go out of fashion. The important thing is for public broadcasters to make the case convincingly that they can pick up the challenge of making sure that there continues to be investment in the content that is demanded. And that is the challenge for us.
Okay, Matteo, Alex, thank you very much indeed. I think a personal note, it's a pity more people weren't here really to hear how fundamental the change is, because much of what we've heard really should be underpinning some of the judgments we're hearing from some delegates in many of these other sessions. Thank you anyway.
Thank you greatly, moderator.